From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
On the panel this week, Linda Feldman, Washington Bureau Chief for the Christian Science Monitor, and Dan Raviv, National Correspondent for Israeli-based channel I-24 News. Our moderator is CBS Radio contributor Michael Williams.
Welcome, everyone. Here are the issues. The Trump administration imposed new sanctions on Russia as a response to the use of a nerve agent on a former Russian spy in Britain and reinstated sanctions against Iran. The moves are the latest in a series of economic sanctions imposed by the administration to influence policy through economic pressure. As the trial of former Trump campaign ad Paul Manafort entered its second week, further testimony by former business partner Rick Gates about Manafort's business dealings were heard, as were a series of interactions that suggest a growing tension between the prosecution and the presiding judge. A special election for a U.S. House of Representatives seat earlier this week remains too close to call, but it gave insight into the prospects for Republicans and Democrats in November's crucial midterm elections. And two separate military actions by U.S. allies Israel and Saudi Arabia raised questions about U.S. engagement in the region and the possibilities for peace. So, a lot to unpack here. So, let's start with the sanctions on Russia and on Iran. The Trump administration imposed sanctions on Russia, again, as the response to this nerve agent being used. And then we have sanctions with Iran. Let's start with the Russia sanctions. Linda, the sanctions that were imposed, give sort of a rundown on what those were. Sure. And really, do they hurt?
So, the latest round of sanctions against the Russians will block exports having anything to do with national security. So it's things like gas turbine engines, electronics, stuff like that. And the interesting thing about sanctions is that, yes, they hurt the economy. But in the case of Russia, the Russian population already thinks America is out to get them and is the boogeyman. So I think it actually helps Vladimir Putin. He's already very popular. I think this just makes him more popular. It has already had an impact on the Russian economy. The ruble has declined in value. But this doesn't hurt the oligarchs and the other rich people who surround Putin. It really hurts the Russian middle class.
With sanctions everywhere, it seems as though that's really the case. Dan, I want you to address the Russian sanctions. Also, maybe give a little description of the Iranian sanctions, which were reimposed, actually, or not imposed. It's a reimposition of prior sanctions. And as Linda did, cut to the chase of it, get to the politics of this whole thing.
Michael, I think it's a story of what's expected and what isn't. When it comes to the new sanctions against Russia announced here in Washington by the State Department, that actually was a surprise because around a month ago, President Trump was sitting with President Vladimir Putin and saying that he wants better relations with Russia, as in what's the use of making Russia angry? And then this comes. So there's one element here, which is that the poisoning by nerve agent of a former Russian spy and his daughter in Britain, that of course angered the British. And so the U.S. actually was acting with our friend, the British, and turning against the Russians on this. I mean, it didn't have to happen, though there was pressure from largely Republicans, members of Trump's own party in Congress, who said, you've got to act against Russia. We have a law passed by Congress that if anyone on the planet uses chemical or biological weapons, there have to be sanctions against them. But still, I felt the Trump administration didn't have to do it. Mm-hmm. Now, you could say the same about the Iran sanctions, right? Mm-hmm. Europeans are saying the U.S. doesn't have to put new sanctions on Iran.
For a completely different reason, completely different context.
Well, that's not a surprise. President Trump's been signaling for a long time that he would leave the Iran nuclear deal of 2015, and he did so in May. So if you leave the deal, what do you do then? Well, he's been demanding that Iran actually come back to the table to negotiate what he calls a better deal, where Iran would be more restricted mm-hmm. in its activities that have to do with nuclear work, mm-hmm. with developing missiles, and even Iranian behavior. Anyway, Iran says it doesn't want to do that. So Trump announced new sanctions on Iran's economy, and according to the White House, more to come. So they really believe in sanctions.
Okay, and again, I want to get to the politics of this, and maybe we can come back to the domestic politics of this. As you said, November, we have elections. How does this base respond to both of these sets of sanctions?
So the base pretty much loves Donald Trump. So there are some Republicans who are holding their nose and supporting Donald Trump because they can't stand the Democrats. So he personally is very warm toward Vladimir Putin. His base is fine with that. They like the argument that it's good to talk to the Russians. I actually agree with that. I think it is good to speak with your adversaries. The problem here is that Donald Trump is not speaking with the rest of his government. It's the most bizarre foreign policy I've ever seen in 30 years in Washington, where you have the president who speaks and tweets statements that completely contradict what the rest of his government is saying. And I know the Russians are confused. They're feeling kind of whiplashed over this. They felt that the summit went well, and now, boom, sanctions over the Novichok attack.
Linda, Michael, have you ever noticed that at the Trump rallies, he had three last week in various states, and he loves talking to the big crowd. When he mentioned that he wants to be friendly with the Russian president, I don't think the crowd applauds quite as much. They usually love everything he says, but actually Americans in the heartland of the U.S. are not, they don't trust Moscow.
Well, there's that.
And so they wonder about that. When he says, I've always been tough on Russia, tougher than anybody, they actually cheer that. So I think the new sanctions probably will be popular with Republican voters and give him and them kind of a cover from now to the election November 6th.
It's interesting. I mean, Trump does, when he's pressured on the question of how he's dealing with Russia, he does say we're tougher than Obama, and he can list all the ways in which the U.S. has instituted sanctions against the Russians, not just economic, but also closing buildings and kicking out diplomats. But the bottom line, I mean, have you also seen at the rallies the T-shirts that say I'd rather be Russian than a Democrat?
Wow.
At Trump rallies.
I've seen them, which I was about to mention. So clearly, I think domestically, it's good policy, good politics for the Trump administration. Dan, I want to close, though, with you and ask you the question, is this really an effective way to run diplomacy, this through economic sanctions and almost no other form of diplomacy?
Well, it's clear that President Trump does not want to do what the previous presidents did, for instance, in the Middle East, but also vis-a-vis Russia, Eastern Europe. And specifically, he doesn't want to commit the U.S. military. President Trump is proud of saying that he has gotten Congress to approve a lot more spending, an increase of some $700 billion a year for defense and the military and acquiring new ships and planes. But he also says he doesn't want to use the military because if we're so strong, we'll never have to. Well, you could see sanctions as an alternative to the military. And so I think it actually fits in with Trump's way of thinking, where money is everything. Mm-hmm. And so trying to strangle a country's economy. And not only that, but the tariffs war. How is he going to get better trade deals? Mm-hmm. By adding tariffs or taxes on products from other countries. He always thinks in terms of money. But if there were a pacifist in this room, he'd say, or she'd say, better than making war.
Yeah, and I think as a novice politician, but a lifelong businessman, it's a context and a framework that he understands a little bit better than working through Foggy Bottom, the State Department, if you will. Let's move along to the Paul Manafort trial, entering its second week, and the prosecution star witness Rick Gates has made really some damaging statements, some damaging testimony. I'm going to start with you, Dan. Can you sort of summarize where we are in this trial and the things that Rick Gates has said?
Okay, for our global audience, who was
Please.
Paul Manafort?
Exactly.
He was the chairman of the Trump for President campaign for 3 months in 2016. Worked for Trump a little bit more than that. And Rick Gates, well, he was Manafort's business partner. Manafort was in charge for years, doing a lot of foreign work in the area of political consulting, including for pro-Russian Ukrainian politicians. So they made a lot of money, according to the prosecution in the Manafort trial. They made some $60 million, but almost half of it not declared on Manafort's taxes. So he's accused of tax evasion, also of bank fraud for improperly getting loans from banks. Now, what does that have to do with the Trump campaign or President Trump? And why is Rick Gates testifying against him? Well, Gates agreed to plead guilty, and so he's testifying against Manafort. But is there anything here about Trump? The president's name hardly ever comes up. A little bit in passing. There was testimony from Gates that we delivered once, baseball tickets in New York to businessman Trump, but that was years ago. The big picture, and it's almost what we speculate, is that the prosecutor, Robert Mueller, the special prosecutor in the Russia collusion with American politics case, he is probably putting pressure on Manafort to give up some information about Trump and the Trump campaign. But it looks so far like Manafort isn't. So here's another question mark for you. Why is Manafort not even trying to save himself? I think he probably supposes that his old friend, President Donald Trump, is going to issue him a pardon. So even
because
if Manafort
is a federal charge, and he has the right to do that.
He can do that. And if Manafort is convicted, boom, he'd be free.
So the thing about collusion is that this trial is intentionally not about collusion. And in fact, there was a moment in the trial this week when the issue of Russia kind of started to come up, and they had a little sidebar, they had a little private conversation, and the judge agreed to keep that conversation off the record. So there was a suggestion that Russia and potential collusion involving Rick Gates and therefore possibly Manafort is there, but currently off the record. So we need to wait for Manafort's second trial, which will take place in D.C.
That's right. He's facing other charges.
He has other charges directly over this issue of collusion. So even though this trial looks like, in many ways, a clean-cut tax evasion bank fraud case, there's more to come.
What has been the response of the White House to this? Dan, what's been the response?
Well, people close to the Trump White House say it has nothing to do with them. Look at the fact that the charges so far against Manafort are not connected with the Trump campaign. So they're watching, but they say they're just not worried about it at all.
Obviously a facade, though, because it has everything to do with them, depending on what gets said into a microphone.
This particular trial, not all that much, but because it's the first trial by the special prosecutor, Robert Mueller, it is a test of Mueller being a success or a flop. And at the White House, they would love Mueller to be a flop, that's for sure.
When you look at some of the trial, and you're following it, the judge in the trial, T.S. Ellis III, he is known as a flamboyant jurist, to say the least, on the bench, and has really given an indication that he has put some very tight rules and tight reins around the prosecution, has admonished them a number of times from the bench, and has even had to withdraw one of those criticisms because it wasn't true,
right?
Or it made a mistake.
Right. Yeah, so then Ellis actually apologized, and that's unusual. So you're right; he's a colorful judge.
Well, is it important? Is it my question? Is it important how this is conducted, because the Trump administration has conducted much of their defense as a PR campaign, as a witch hunt, as a burden, something where the poor Trump administration officials are being hunted by the government. Does the conduct in this trial make a difference?
It makes a huge difference, actually. So the judge is really trying to speed things along. He's trying to keep the prosecution in particular on track and narrowly focused on Manafort and his finances. And the reason is that he doesn't want this to get overturned on appeal. He wants the jury to reach a conclusion and have that be it. Judges don't like to be appealed in a higher court.
We're going to have to take a break right here. Stay with us for more Issues in the News.
Here's a reminder that you're listening to Issues in the News on the Voice of America in Washington. If you would like to download the program, it's free on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com. And don't forget to like us on Facebook. Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Now back to our panel. Linda Feldman, Washington Bureau Chief for the Christian Science Monitor, and Dan Raviv, National Correspondent for Israeli-based channel I-24 News. Moderator is Michael Williams, CBS Radio contributor.
Welcome back to Issues in the News. Dan, did you have a closing statement that you wanted to make on this Manafort trial and where this is going?
Well, I still don't think that it's the central focus of all the questions about Donald Trump and will he be in trouble, because at the same time, there was a lot of talk as to whether Donald Trump will agree to be questioned by that special prosecutor, Robert Mueller. Mm-hmm. And Trump's personal attorney, Rudy Giuliani, former mayor of New York, he gave signals in different directions, but he said, we suggested to Mueller if it's restricted, if he restricts what his questions are, and maybe even some of the president's answers would be in writing, then there could be a questioning session. Well, there's no indication that Mueller is accepting that, and so they're playing a game, and I think our eye is more on that.
Yeah.
Again, it's a lot of it is being played out in the court of public opinion, but certainly Manafort is in the actual court, and this result will be of interest for sure. So this past week, we had the special election for a U.S. House of Representatives seat, the 12th District of Ohio, and a Democrat, Danny O'Connor, was facing off against a Republican state senator, Troy Balderson, who was endorsed, quite interestingly, by President Trump and by Ohio Governor John Kasich, who's also a frequent critic of
two Republicans who don't like each other.
Who don't like each other at all. But Republicans and Democrats are both preparing their spin for however this comes out. It's a district that Trump carried comfortably in the 2016 presidential race. Linda, I turn to you. This is in your wheelhouse. This election, very closely watched. Why is this one a little bit different than some of the other special elections that we've seen?
So we're now less than 3 months away from the midterms, and this was the last special election. So the Republicans have won most of the special elections that have happened since Trump was elected, and Trump brags about this. But the margins have been much closer than the political makeup of the district would suggest. And of course, the Republicans lost that Senate race in Alabama. Alabama is one of the most Republican states in the country. So there were special circumstances there. But the bottom line is that this last race, this Ohio race, was really a canary in the coal mine, meaning that it was a warning sign. Republicans are openly saying this. They are very worried about November. A lot of Republican and independent political analysts say that the House is pretty much out the door. The Democrats are going to retake control of the House. This will serve as a check on Donald Trump. This means the Democrats will have the ability to hold, to conduct investigations and have hearings.
Subpoena power,
and the I word, impeachment.
Right.
Big movement among some Democrats. The establishment Democrats don't like the impeachment movement, but there's this demand burbling up from the left to impeach Donald Trump because they can't stand him and think he's unfit for office, even though there's virtually no way, based on what we know now, that the Senate would convict him and throw him out of office.
Dan, you talked earlier about the president's sort of campaign-style trips that he's taken, one of which he made to Ohio, during which he endorsed Troy Balderson, actually claimed for something like a 20 to 30% move in his poll ratings based on that visit. Win or lose, what does this mean for the Republicans? And President Trump is talking about the possibility of a red wave now. That's sort of a hashtag that he's using. At all possible?
And red is the color in this country for the Republican Party, right? And the Democrats are praying and hoping for a blue wave in November of Democrat Party victories all across the country. Now Trump is indeed claiming a victory in Ohio, including for Balderson, even as it was declared too close to call at this point, and there might even be a recount. But the thing to think about is that one congressional district in Ohio was so Republican. And Trump defeated Hillary Clinton in that district by about a dozen percentage points, and this turned out to be close. If there's going to be a 12 percentage point swing all across the country, then the Democrats would have their blue wave. Now, the president is denying it entirely. He says he's going to get out and campaign in the last 2 months from Labor Day, the big holiday in this country, early September, until the election November 6th. He claims he might even be on the road 6 days a week helping Republicans. Just think about this, though. Republicans are wondering, does he really help? Because he wouldn't help in every district, that's for sure.
Exactly. I want to throw that to you, Linda. Some of these special elections have been referendums on the candidate, and some have been a referendum on the president. And by campaigning so ferociously as he is, I'm going to say, threatening to do on behalf of these candidates, is he turning each and every election into a referendum on the presidency? Mm-hmm. And is that a good idea?
It's totally a referendum on this presidency. And he...
Regardless of whether he does it or not.
Right. So he needs to be careful about where he goes. Troy Balderson did not want Donald Trump to come campaign in his district. And Trump came anyway. Trump loves this. He loves getting in there. He loves having these rallies. He loves the warmth of his supporters getting up there and waving signs and just throwing love his way. But the district that just voted in Ohio had a big suburban element to it. And the suburbs, particularly suburban women, are veering away from Donald Trump. They're offended by his language, his tweets. They view this as unacceptable, even if they are card-carrying members of the Republican Party. And it's a big question when the president goes to campaign in a district, is he getting his base rallied? There's an argument for that. It's getting his people excited. Or is he ginning up the opposition and making them turn out? I think it's a balancing act, but in a district like Ohio's 12th congressional district, you can argue that it probably hurt the Republican to have Trump out there.
I think you're probably right about that. Dan, really quickly.
That's what all the analysts say. I think Trump's going to find enough friendly districts where he can go, and even his political advisors would say, this is going to help, Mr. President. And then you're right, Linda, the president really wants to do it, too. It sort of charges his batteries. Mm-hmm. But, you know, listen to this program in the middle of November, just after America's election. I think we're going to see something strong, one way or the other. Because if the Republicans still hang on to the House of Representatives, they will feel so relieved, and liberal Democrats in this country will be shocked. How did we lose again like Hillary Clinton lost? Or, as most people think is more likely, the Democrats will win control of the House.
You know, this is, there's a lot of political, like technical stuff here. You know, this is for the Washington types. You know, we can really get into this. We could do a half an hour just on one district, you know, and this sort of thing. And I want to throw this to either one of you who wants to take it up. Did the Democrats, as they are sort of fielding candidates here and getting results that are better than expected, are they learning more and more about the type of Democrat that wins? Is the era of a national Democratic candidate over, and we're getting more towards a local Democrat in the way that I believe it was when we were all coming up, if I'm going to say that,
That's a really interesting question, because we sitting here in Washington have a kind of national view of these things. But really, in these district-by-district races, it's really important to nominate the right candidate. America is a very varied place. You have Democrats that can almost look like Republicans, can be conservative on their values, on social issues, in their attitudes toward the economy, say, supporting free trade. And then you have districts that are nominating Democratic socialists, as in New York recently. So as we've seen in, for example, in the Pennsylvania special election, the Democratic Party of Pennsylvania chose, that one was chosen, not in a primary, but handpicked, the absolutely perfect candidate. Conservative in some ways, but also pro-labor. The labor movement will be very important in these midterms as the unions in this country are trying to save themselves after an adverse Supreme Court ruling.
Oh, it's interesting. We talk about having compromise in Congress. It takes people who have agreement across issues and across parties. So I think
but let's keep the big picture in mind, if we will, Michael and Linda, that still the Democratic Party has to come up with one hero to run for president with that election in November of 2020. One hero, more toward the Democratic Socialist type that you mentioned, or, you know, a down the middle, just be very different than Donald Trump, just a steady, smart, eloquent person, man or woman. I think that's what the Democrats are looking for.
Yeah, that person is certainly incubating out there somewhere, waiting for the timer to go off on that particular cake. Dan, I want to credit you for giving putting this issue, this last issue, on our radar. Thank you very much for that. In Yemen, Saudi and U.S.-backed government forces conducted an airstrike on the Houthi-controlled north of the country that targeted a school bus. And dozens were killed and injured, many of them children. And in Gaza, Israel launched a series of airstrikes that were in Hamas-controlled Gaza in response to a series of rocket attacks against Israel, initiating from Hamas strongholds. You have a lot of insight into this area and in this region. I just want you to really address this as a summary of these two issues, and how can we tie these into how the U.S. is conducting Middle East policy?
Just think about that. Palestinian Gaza, and on the other side of the Middle East, Yemen in the Gulf, and that's not to mention the Syrian civil war, which has been, you know, absolutely horrible since early in the year 2011. Well, first, the Gaza frontier, not for the first time. It just keeps happening again and again. There's an outbreak of violence between the Palestinians, mainly the Hamas faction that does not accept Israel and is very militant. They run Gaza. And the Israelis, who say they just want peace and quiet on the border, but even a single rocket that comes over from Hamas in Gaza, the Israelis feel they have to respond. They have some brilliant defensive anti-rocket systems, but still, they can't get them all. And so some Israelis were wounded, some Palestinians were killed, including a pregnant woman and her child. And so all of this made headlines with no sign at all of an answer. Is the U.S. mediating? No, I just wanted to make that clear. The State Department here put out its opinion on that. Hamas is to blame for all the problems in Gaza. Israel has a right to defend itself and do whatever it needs to make sure that these provocations don't happen. So the Trump administration is just simply on Israel's side. Now, when it comes to what happened in Yemen, the Saudi-led coalition conducts bombing raids against Houthi rebels, but this time they hit a school bus. 49 kids were killed. The pictures are horrible. The whole world knows about it. Saudi Arabia is not apologizing, and the State Department is saying, we expect Saudi Arabia to investigate this, but no condemnation. The U.S. supplies weapons and intelligence and targeting information to Saudi Arabia. And so the U.S. is just standing firm with its friends, in this case, Israel and Saudi Arabia.
And so in a world that looks to the U.S. for leadership, we await leadership from the administration on those issues.
Or the Trump White House would say, we're standing with our friends. Don't trouble us with the details. It's horrible when civilians die, but they claim to be looking at the big picture.
I'm afraid that's all the time we have for this week. Thanks to Linda Feldman, Washington Bureau Chief for the Christian Science Monitor, and Dan Raviv, National Correspondent for Israeli-based channel I-24 News. This program is produced by VOA's Current Affairs. Our engineer is Justin Thwaites, and I'm Michael Williams, CBS Radio contributor. Thanks for listening.